Well, what are the police doing in response to a rise of gang-related violence around the country? The spotlight's currently fixed on Tauranga. In recent weeks in the Tauranga and Western Bay of Plenty regions, there have been two shootings, two businesses lost to a suspected arson in what is believed to be a territory war between gangs, and a total of four people dead. To allay community fears, police have boosted their presence in Bay of Plenty as well as in the Manawatū region after a string of gang-related violence there too. An arson in Christchurch on Friday is also believed to be part of tension between a newly established gang and an existing one. Late last year, 9 to Noon spoke to Eastern District Police following a spate of violent incidents in Napier, which had prompted police to set up a gang focus unit. There have been further gang-related incidents in recent months, including a shooting in Taradale in January, and increase in community safety fears. Many of these problems have been put down to competition in a burgeoning meth market, and also the impact of Australian gangs coming here. So-called 501s, deportees under Australia's tough policy, setting up new brands and new ways of doing things. Police National Organised Crime National Manager Detective Superintendent Greg Williams is with us. Good morning and thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Catherine.
Could you explain the police understanding of what this spate of violent deaths in Tauranga is about? To what extent are they or aren't they gang-related?
Look, I think the first thing we need to understand is, you know, New Zealand has had a significant gang culture going back some years. You know, I've been in the police now 40 years. And through that time, we've seen a sort of a development of gangs from early days when they basically were pretty much operated as criminals on the street at a lower level. Through to the changes in morphing in the around 2000 when meth arrived. And why? Because it allowed gangs to obtain far more money and asset than they probably ever had access to. And in that time, we saw really that shaping of what we would describe as the criminal business entity model, where we're dealing here with a situation right now of probably supply and demand going on through communities. So that shaped them up. And since about 2014, through a raft of things that have been things within New Zealand and things external to New Zealand, we've seen quite a dynamic change in that environment and a massive expansion of gangs across the country. I think it's well said in the media and others, you know, that some of that impact is in fact the policies of Australia to start to deport people back here, which they're absolutely entitled to do. Now, that's seen quite a change and a development within this country, and we've seen quite aggressive social media marketing by gangs in the way in which they can attract people into gangs. At the same time, we saw China pushing the manufacture of methamphetamine out of China and into areas such as Myanmar, where we had transnational groups manufacturing methamphetamine en masse, which saw the price of it drop. And it saw those gangs in New Zealand and transnational groups taking advantage of that to bring that product into the country. As that price drops, it meant that groups in New Zealand, and you know, traditionally we had groups that were involved in the importation, and primarily across the country, mainly gangs drive the retail sale of meth into our communities. That allowed a lot more gangs to get into this. And What we have now, sort of almost a perfect storm of, a dropping price, access to this product, and then, you know, the gangs realised that they could actually sell this product into pretty socially deprived communities. So as that all happens, we've had the Australian gangs themselves set up here, so the Rebels, we've had the Bandidos, expanding into this lucrative market here as well.
So if we look, we've had a figure of something like a 58% increase in gang membership in the last 2 years. So that's sizable. So is that driven by the perfect storm, or is that significantly related to the new style gangs and their recruiting? Is much of the growth into the new gangs?
I think it's both, actually. I think it's actually both, and so we've, you know, and the thing here is that, like, You know, we've done, you know, national organised crime groups. So it's at the very at the top end. We're focusing on those transnational crime groups and the top organised crime groups in this country that are focused on bringing this product in and dispersing across the country. So we've sort of done those transnational operations, but also at a local level as well. So, you know, we've been in and seen the impact of these groups, you know, on communities. You know, a good example, is Carrow, a community where we charged 42 people tied to the Carrow Mongrel mob with dealing methamphetamine into that community. So you what you do when you go in and see this is you see, you know, basically almost an entrapment or enslavement of a large swathe of that community. Nearly 600 people we identified using meth in that community. You know, so what you're getting here is these gangs have an ability to make significant money. And off the back of that, then you'll see assets. You know, we're seeing a lot of these gangs morphing from what we traditionally thought as ethnic-type gangs to motorcycle gangs now. So the young people coming there out of these communities look at these groups now, and they see the social marketing, the bling, the muscles, the motorbikes, the assets, and that draws them in into these gangs.
Which gangs are they joining? Are the young people who are driving that massive growth in 2 years, are they joining the traditional gangs, Mongrel Mob or Black Power or even Headhunters, or are they joining rebels, bandidos, Mongols?
You know, it's interesting. I think the bulk of that increase has actually been into groups like the Mongrel Mob and the like. There's been actually a massive expansion of Mongrel Mob. And there's been a change. We've seen the Kingdom chapters out of Waikato and the Barbarian chapters out of Eastern. What they're kind of morphing into is almost transnational crime groups, because they have quite significant links. And those groups are actually now expanding back into Australia. So Australia's actually seeing an expansion of Mongrel Mob back over there off the back of this. So you can see quite a dynamic morphing in those groups. And behind it is deportees that have come back to this country and changed that. So what I'm saying here is, the Mongols, for instance, is a 501 Bandidos chapter out of Brisbane that got deported back here. So they've now established themselves right in the heart of Bay of Plenty. So you will see this expansion off the back of this is, you know, at the moment off our wastewater, we believe probably around about $600 million a year is generated in the sale of methamphetamine in this country.
Let's look with the traditional gangs in New Zealand, the Mongrel Mob, Black Power, that you say are growing. Are we talking about new generation leadership, though? We are talking about some of the members who were there, as you said, in the 70s, where it was a different focus. It was about primarily about a different set of issues that people were attracted to these gangs.
Yeah.
You're now seeing a younger generation saying, "Nah, this is about money and showing, you know, and showing the money we can make." And have the older, more senior leadership essentially lost control of who's running those gangs?
Well, I just think it's complex. It's not as simple as that. You know, you've had those gangs in our country for a long time. There's a lot of familial links within those gangs, but yeah, there's a changing dynamic. And in fact, one of the interesting things now, you'll see gangs handing patches out very quickly now. As opposed to in the past where you had to be a prospect and do some time and the like around that. But primarily, most of what we're seeing in across the country in terms of the gang activity is pretty much in the space of methamphetamine distribution across there. I mean, there's other areas. I mean, we're looking holistically at how these groups operate. And, you know, again, a complex issue running in here around legitimate income versus illegal income and racketeering and intimidation and violence that sits on behind us. So you know, here's the point of what you're seeing now around the violence. So, absolutely, what are we doing about this? Well, you know, as you'll see, there's a couple of things that have to happen, and I think this is stuff that we've really started to understand. Traditionally, in the past, we would have gone and policed, charged a number of people with offences, you know, as we would have done in Carrow, and we would have moved on to something else. But we understand now that really across government and working with community, that we have to now start to look at how do we make these communities resilient, not only to the demand and the impact of methamphetamine, but also resilient to the kids and people being drawn into these gangs. And then how do we actually help people exit out of this?
I mean, that's always been the story, Greg, except that now the numbers and the reach, and in the case of Kauro, as you say, the extent of the influence is so great. Could we just come back to a moment to some of the violence, because some of the reason that this has come out from under and has been such a talk of conversation is that suburbs that have never seen gang violence in Napier or in Tauranga are seeing people being bashed in sports fields. And I'm interested as to what's happening with that visual violence. Is this related to turf wars, the arsons that we're seeing here? And it's why I asked the original question about Tauranga, because four violent deaths in a short period of time is alarming. But is it the police view that that was not necessarily a gang versus gang situation? It had other factors.
No, I don't think that's the case. What we're saying is violence has been endemic in gangs from when they were first created. So, you know, what you're doing here is you're seeing an impact, an influx of violent actions happening at various areas, and it's natural for us to look at this and go, this is out of control and this is happening. But, you know, all the time we're actually policing these types of actions across our communities. Yes, 100%, we have a situation where, and we've said this, that you can only squeeze so many people into a market. And I find it interesting when I see gangs come out and say, look, these guys are coming on our turf, they're taking our work and the like. Well, most of that is actually, if you just take this back to the simple concept of the turf, you're dealing here with basically a patch is almost a franchise to earn money within the group, in the area in which the group controls. And so it's a lucrative market, as we said. And you just remember when I say 600 million, you've got to think about just what impact that has across our community for our families and our children through methamphetamine alone. So they control these areas, and when these new groups come in, those gangs around them, obviously, there's sometimes it's negotiated in amongst the groups about how they'll operate, but sometimes it'll extend to violence, and a gang will say, no, we don't accept you being here.
What's your strategy then? Given this change has amped up so much in the last 2 years, what's the police strategy?
Okay, so as I said to you, we have a far greater understanding of impact on communities, and the work that we're now doing is across the country now is bringing in the type of work that happened in Kauro, where we're making and focusing with other community groups, with iwi, with government agencies about making these communities resilient to both methamphetamine and, drawing people into gangs. Now, that's really important for us, because if you think about it, we say a lot of this has been driven by the dealing and the cash and the money side to it. The more people we pull out of the methamphetamine addiction cycle, the less money is going to gangs, and we start to depower their strength and ability to control those communities. So that's not simple, all right? That's going to take a while to do. We are and do every day enforce gangs, and we are both proactive and reactive to gang violence in the sense. But let's just think about this too, because if I look since 2016, our national gang list, and look at the representation of gangs and charges across the broad spectrum, it sits at between sort of 5 to 20% of all charges laid in this country. So, we've got to understand that in terms of you may see specific violence, and yes, we will go out and enforce that. We are in the process now of designing a program right through New Zealand. We are in the middle of a 3 to 4 year, 5 year process of additional resource coming from government that will focus on organised crime, both at the district level and at the national level. We're working with international partners to try and disrupt transnational crime overseas. Last year, for instance, that seizing of about 12 to 1,300 kilos of methamphetamine last year between sort of July and August wasn't a fluke. That's come out of because we have a far better understanding of the supply systems, and we're focused in on trying to drive that down. And an interesting stat is since the beginning of last year, and our wastewater data showed about 16.8 kilos of meth being consumed across New Zealand. So that's across all communities. At the end of this year, that was down to about 13 kilos. And what's interesting about that is I don't think that's necessarily about the fact that we have taken that big amount of meth out. I think maybe we're hoping that we're seeing across communities an understanding of just how bad meth is and what it's doing, and maybe that development of resilience against and resistance to using it. You know, I mean, every day you can see in the news sad stories about people addicted to methamphetamine and the impact. And I think, you know, communities need to start to do what Cara and others are doing and saying we don't want this in our community. And that is probably one of the most significant things that will depower and the market that's currently out there.
Then you're left to what the lure is and how much of this is things like housing problems, family violence problems, existing health problems that have been since childhood. You're talking about really complex social factors, and you're asking for people to make a really rational decision when they've clearly made an irrational decision, given what meth does to people. It seems the right track, but by no means an immediate solution. Unless what does Kōurō need? What does Kōurō need to decouple the lure of these gangs, and, or more importantly, perhaps more directly, the drugs that have flooded it? What does it need to build that resilience?
So you raise a very good point there. So here is a community with half the population on a benefit, a quarter of the population unemployed, a high percentage of Māori in that community, 600 users out of a population of 6,000. What we discovered when we went in there, and the first thing is enforcement, right? So the point here is those people prepared to sell methamphetamine into communities need to be held accountable. So the top echelon groups need to be taken out of the community, charged, and in prison, right? And we presented evidence last year to the Court of Appeal on this fact. But what we also said to the Court of Appeal to get a sense of where New Zealand fitted into this is there are people at the bottom end being addicted by these gangs to sell meth on their behalf. And what we need to do with those people is we need to identify that that's actually a major health issue with them and work hard to get them out of that cycle.
So they won't be prosecuted they won't be charged with supplying methamphetamine. They will be treated as a health issue.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, if they're dealing, they still... The point is, in the old regime, they all went to prison. Under this new case, Court of Appeal Zhang, the court recognises that rehabilitation is the way to pull those people out. So Te Araranga in Northland is the classic example of where we want to focus on trying to draw people out of methamphetamine addiction while at the same time focusing on those people at the top end that are actually driving this market. And then the enablers, the professional facilitators, the enablers in these groups that allow these gangs to move their cash and money, you know, focus with the SIPR Act on taking the assets off them.
Are you going to come down so I'm hearing the demand side, right, and now we're talking about the supply side. Yep. In Australia, we heard about the Australian example, and I think, I don't want to draw politics into it, one of the political parties was certainly talking about flying squads and zero tolerance and in your face if you haven't got a warrant of fitness on your motorbike. There's only a certain number of gangs here, Greg, and there must be only a certain number of senior strategic figures in them. So how do you get at that side of their operations, and will you toughen up proactively how you come at that side of the operation?
Look, as I said to you, you know, the purpose of us, the purpose of the transnational organised crime group and others is focusing on those enablers at the top end and taking them out. You know, there's challenges in there in doing that, but as I said, we've been pretty successful, over the last 3-4 years at identifying those top end enablers, the people that are bringing this product in, the cartels that are turning up here from Mexico. You know, we've taken out 22 transnational operational cells. These are groups that have come into New Zealand and set up here independent to basically provide that product across the retail networks and push the money out of New Zealand. So I think, you know, we are, you know, there is a multiple levels going on here, both within police and with other agencies to impact on a daily basis organised crime.
How much would it help if Australia stopped exporting back, deporting back to New Zealand, criminals from their country who left here as babies?
The reality right now is Australia's perfectly entitled to deport those people because they are not citizens. New Zealand deports people. In the United States, it's not uncommon. That won't change things now. You know, it's the reality is the scene has changed now, and we have to deal with the scene we have. You know, the interesting thing I think that concerns us really is, you know, our guys have predicted this is we in Australia, where you have a gang confrontation, you see an elevation of violence, whereas traditionally in New Zealand there's been some violence in negotiation. And some of the actions we've seen recently is about that elevation up by these groups coming in. There's a myriad of issues that also come with those people deported around mental health, addiction as well, you know, and their disconnection to New Zealand, which in essence makes them, you know, act in the way they do. Over the last 3 to 4 years, we've had a clear understanding of where our major threats are in the organised crime space, and those are the gangs and transnational groups that we're focused and targeted on, and will continue to do. So, as I said, over the next 2 to 3 years, something like about 300 to 400 additional staff coming across the country in organised crime spaces. We've had resource coming in over the last 3 years where we've started to embed that. So now we're shaping up this national plan in terms of how that respond.
Thank you, Greg.
I think the most important thing here is we want to get the right people out of prison and the right people in, if that makes sense too. I think that's the other key thing we understand.
Thanks. I hope we'll talk again. Greg Williams is the police detective, a superintendent from National Organised Crime.